Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Kara Hetland.
And I'm Keely Boltina in for Lori Walsh. A panel with people from all branches of state government is examining public safety improvement in South Dakota.
The latest report details finances and finding from prison to parole, all in an effort to improve outcomes, hold offenders accountable close to home, and focus corrections resources on violent criminals.
Lori Feiler is Deputy Secretary of South Dakota's Department of Corrections. She's also the chair of the 2016 Public Safety Improvement Act Oversight Council. She joins us live on the phone. Lori Feiler, welcome to In the Moment.
Thank you very much.
The report is quite a few pages long, but it breaks everything down into really 10 key findings, and they run the gamut. So I want to back up before we get into those and talk about this concept that we can now figure out whether some of the changes we've made to corrections in South Dakota are making a difference compared to how we would have projected them in the past. Can you give us a little bit of context for this?
Yeah, so sure can. You know, I appreciated some of your introductory comments. You know, you did a nice job of, summarizing really what the goals of the Public Safety Improvement Act were, you know, and that was to improve public safety by investing in things that actually promote rehabilitation and reduce recidivism, you know, holding folks accountable in the community, and then controlling corrections spending, where we can really focus on violent and the chronic and career criminals rather than the nonviolent folks. You know, there's been a lot of work that's been done over the last 3.5 years in this project. There's still additional work to be done, but there's definitely a lot of things I think that across the state we should be proud of. And it's really involved the work of a lot of different agencies. You know, this isn't just a DOC thing, and I think that's one of the things that's making the Public Safety Improvement Act so successful is that this is really across state government and across both state and local government and also involving the private sector. You know, UJS is involved with this, DOC, AG's office, tribal government, private providers, local treatment community, and local law enforcement have all been involved in this effort. So I think that that's really, really strengthened it. One of the things that people look at almost right away is the prison population. And if folks are looking or have an opportunity to look at the 2016 annual report, you'll see on page 4 is where we really highlight what's been going on with the prison population. And I'm kind of getting over a little bit of a bug here.
So I feel like everybody is this time of year, so no worries at all. Right, because you're talking about in the annual report that earlier there was a projection of where the prison population should be at this point in time, and the numbers that we have right now fall below that projection if we hadn't made changes, right?
That's absolutely right. Back in 2012, when the initial criminal justice work group was put together, the state was involved with some technical assistance with the Pew Centers for the State, and they had done some projections in terms of if we didn't do any of these interventions, where would we expect our prison population to be? And we're still, at the time the report was published, we were still about 270 inmates below where we would have been without any of these changes.
Okay, so why is it good that we have fewer people in prison? Because it's not necessarily that fewer people are committing crimes or even being caught, tried, prosecuted, but why is it good in general if our prison numbers are lower?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. In South Dakota, still an awful lot of our prison inmates are doing time for violent or nonviolent offenses. And typically, if a person can be safely retained in the community and get services in the community, that's typically more effective in reducing their future criminality. You know, some folks have to go to prison, and we just recognize that. But if we can safely retain people in the community with additional services and additional supervision, that's a much more pro-social environment, and it's a much more practical environment where they can practice their sobriety skills and their responsibility skills, where prison is not the best place to practice that pro-social stuff. So if they can safely be retained in the community, they generally do better.
And what does it look like now, though, as far as the number of people who are nonviolent that we are putting in prison? I mean, has that... has that increased or decreased? And if they don't go to prison, I mean, are we really specifically talking about drug courts?
Yeah, we're really talking about a lot of different interventions, and I think I'm going to kind of try to answer your question kind of in two parts.
Okay.
You know, the first is concurrent with the strategies with the Public Safety Improvement Act. Unfortunately, South Dakota has also really seen an increase in the impact that methamphetamine has in the state. And we see that reflected in the increase in crimes reported and arrests and convictions and, frankly, people going to prison as well. So those two things are happening concurrently, and that's challenging some of the and it would be even more challenging if we didn't have the Public Safety Improvement Act. But that is challenging some of the things. So we continue to have a lot of nonviolent folks in prison. And part of that is because of some of the pressure, I think, that the meth is putting on us as a state.
So by getting them in prison, they're not dealing in meth, I guess, outside the walls.
Yep. And what happens, I think, is the chronicity of it, is that a person maybe is originally put on probation or is released on parole, but then they continue to have problems. And eventually the court determines, no, they really do have to go to prison because they continue to have problems with this, even though it doesn't escalate to a violent crime, but it's just the chronicity of the nonviolent. You know, you had said, you know, is drug courts really the only other option? And I would say, no, it's not. There's a lot of provisions that are in place in the community to try to provide appropriate resources. You know, the specialty courts, which is kind of the umbrella term for drug courts, DUI courts, and veterans courts. I think as a state, we went, I believe, from 5 such specialty courts up to 12 over the last several years. So that's definitely increased. There's also the HOPE probation program, which is available, I believe, in 3 circuits, which is an intensive drug testing program for folks that are on probation. We've also done a lot of training for our supervising agents and the judiciary and our Board of Pardons and Paroles and what works in community supervision. And so I think just the interactions that our parole staff and our court staff have with offenders, I think we're trained to be effective and try to really elicit the behavior change with them with that. You know, on DOC side, we also have the tribal parole program, which we piloted a couple years ago and now have converted to a part of DOC's base budget. And that's, of course, for people who are coming out of prison rather than people who, you know, are avoiding prison. But we found some pretty good successes with that tribal parole program. And then finally, I'd like to mention, you know, there's been a significant investment in treatment resources in the community through the Public Safety Improvement Act. There's the substance abuse program is called Cognitive Behavioral Interventions for Substance Abuse. We call it CBISA. And then moral recognition therapy, which kind of deals with irresponsible thinking. Some people call it criminal thinking, that oftentimes leads to legal problems. There's been a lot of investment in the community to make those services available statewide for folks, again, for folks who are diverted from prison, to allow them to access those services. And those have turned out to be preliminary information is they're very, very successful if you can get people through them.
And the 2016 report does anchor what you're saying in numbers. This isn't an anecdotal, well, we think this is working. I mean, the information that I can see is that more than half of the people who enter substance abuse treatment through this are successfully completing the program. And there are lower rates of felony conviction for people who have completed these programs. I mean, significantly. It looks like, what is the number here? 88% of people who completed the program did not commit a felony within 1 year of treatment. I mean, that level of breaking that recidivism, cycle has to make a difference in the long term. I guess that's the hope, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, when we compare it with our regular 1-year recidivism rate for DOC, folks who've gone through the SABISA, which is the substance abuse, they recidivated at a 9% rate at 12 months, and folks who went through the MRT recidivated at a 14% rate. So both were significantly under what our overall one-year recidivism rate is. So
what is that usually?
Well, our overall one-year rate is about 20%.
Wow. So that is a difference. That's cut in half for sure.
Yes. Yep.
And when we are looking through other elements of this report, I want to bring in another member of the council of the committee. We have, you mentioned people from, you know, local government and from UJS and from corrections and from the governor's office. A couple of state lawmakers also participated, and former state representative Jacqueline Sly. I talked to her briefly about her time on this, and she says that one of the challenges that she noticed is that there are some really great things happening in some places that don't necessarily work across the board, and some things that fail don't fail all over the place either. Let me play a little clip from her.
What might work in one part of the state may not work as well in another part, and so I think that as a state, sometimes it's very, we are very quick to say, oh, this isn't working, and then just change all of it instead of saying, well, we do have some good results here. What's really contributing to that? And a lot of it, I think, really boils down to relationships that are built, the willingness of the community to be a part of that decision-making and seeking solutions, and then also the implementation of it is huge. When you know, you can plan all the best things in the world, but you run into some challenges, and then you just kind of back away instead of working through those, it's going to make it a lot harder. And that's why I think it's really important for all of our state to really not just sit back and say, oh, well, they're taking care of it, and it doesn't work that way.
So, Lori Feiler, you're with the Department of Corrections, and you've chaired this committee, and I just want to know, how do we, in such a diverse state, apply some of these tactics? I mean, are there things that work in some places that don't work elsewhere, or are there some inconsistencies with how we're trying to do really strategies that are rooted in good ideas?
Yeah, I really appreciated Representative Sly's comments. I mean, she's just been a great advocate for looking at these fairly challenging problems, and she's absolutely right. I mean, a lot of, when we've got a big initiative like this, one of the things that I always say is the devil's in the details. And when things maybe aren't working quite right, then we have to be willing to step back, talk to the folks that are involved and say, okay, how can we retool this? How can we modify this so this is going to work better in terms of the implementation? You know, one of the things that I thought of when I was listening to the clip from Representative Sly was the initiative that DSS put together on providing some substance abuse services through a telehealth type of delivery. Again, with rural South Dakota, accessing services can be really challenging. And one of the really neat things that DSS did to respond to that is to try some telehealth delivery of substance abuse services. And I think that's a good example of having to accommodate the different needs and the circumstances of a state like South Dakota that's so diverse.
Is there another place where over the last couple of years with this you've noticed, gosh, we thought this would really work, and in practice it just didn't make sense for the boots on the ground?
Oh, you're putting me on the spot here. Let me think here.
Or are there maybe successes that you thought, well, this might work in one place, and then that has just kind of spread statewide, and we realized it was more universal than mm-hmm. you could think before?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the success program that comes to mind when I think about wanting to spread it out more is the Tribal Parole Program that we've had up in Sisseton in the last couple of years. That's just turned out to be a really neat program. And we're continuing to work to try to find additional locations where we can put together a state tribal parole program that would reflect, the needs and the desires of that particular community. But the tribal parole program up in Sisseton has really been, as I said, a really cool thing in terms of working with the local wellness team up there and allowing folks who are on state parole to be able to, you know, be supervised and case managed back in their own communities.
What do we need to do better in South Dakota?
I think we just need to keep working at it. I think we need to realize that some of these things, this is huge work, and this is important work. And I know I'm oftentimes impatient, and I think a lot of people a lot of times are impatient, that if we don't see results or we see things that are frustrating, that sometimes it's tempting to say, well, that didn't work, and step away from it when we actually haven't given it a chance. So I think that we need to stay the course with some of this work and continue to be willing to make adjustments as we move along. There's many, many good things. Even though we're seeing some challenges right now with the mess stuff, there's many, many good things that have occurred through this this work. And I think we need to just keep our resolve and keep our will going and work on the things that our people, you know, that may not be working great, and continuing to build on our successes.
Sure, but this is this seems like an uphill battle. This is a major initiative. You have so many pieces moving at the same time. So how do you keep that resolve? How do you make sure that all the partners continue to work together and look at the information in this report and say, okay, we're making some strides, but we've got to do better. This is how.
Yep. You know, I think a lot of it is communication, and that's, you know, one of the things that came about because of the Public Safety Improvement Act is this Oversight Council. What is, you know, if we're really serious about this, then we have to hold ourselves accountable to say, what do the outcomes look like? And we have to be able to publish those outcomes and talk about those. And the Oversight Council provides that mechanism. I mean, it's a requirement of state law that the Oversight Council looks at the performance measures on all of these initiatives and gets briefed at least twice a year in terms of the progress being made. And then, of course, the annual report also that you had started the broadcast at referring to. All of those things kind of keep the light shining on what's going on with this and require the reports so that Oversight Council can take a look at them and suggest, you know, revisions or say, hey, you know, this is great.
I imagine that concept of communication then also kind of filters out into the report as I look at details about the number of days that people who are sentenced with felonies spend in county jails, because we're hearing at the different levels and the different kinds of law enforcement that everybody is stretched and everyone is challenged. So that interaction between the local jails and the, you know, state or federal level authorities has to be critical. Tell me about those findings and how you are working on that relationship.
Absolutely. I mean, it's communication, communication, communication.
Right? Over and over and over.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep. You can never communicate too much. You know, at the very end of the report, we talk about the number of days that were spent in county jail for felony sentencing, that's actually decreased over the last couple of years, both total and then by individual offenders. You know, we have folks on the Oversight Council that represent the state's attorney's office, and we also have folks, as I said, from, or as you had pointed out, from the legislature and from the executive branch and judicial branch. We also try to make an effort to talk with local law enforcement, sheriff's office, police chiefs, local state's attorneys, in terms of what we're doing in DOC and with parole. And having some of those dialogues, I think, really oftentimes can at least identify where maybe miscommunication is or where the problems are, and where we can start working on, okay, what can we do to address this?
I don't want to let you go before we get to the topics of parole and probation then, as referenced in the report. So let's start with parole, because I think sometimes people see parole as kind of like an excuse you're letting them off the hook because they didn't serve their full time. What's the point of parole, and what did the numbers tell us? Why are they good or bad?
Yeah, parole is to provide a period of case management and supervision and support after their prison sentence. And the way South Dakota's parole system works is we actually have a presumption of parole. If person is so inclined to read through the state law, there's a grid that establishes when a person will be entitled to a release on their initial parole date. So if an inmate does everything they're supposed to do, the way our system is set up is they do a period of time in prison and a period of time on parole.
That's just how it is on paper.
Yes, that's just how it is. It's not. The only time the parole board will make a decision on a parole is if a person had a previous violation.
Sure. And when we're looking at, the report itself references that 30% of the parole population is at indirect or minimum level of supervision. What do we infer from that? Is that a good thing?
I don't know if you can really put a good or a bad label on it. We have a validated risk process that we do to assess a person who is on supervision, and it's based on their history, what their criminal history is like, what their supervision history is like, kind of their stabilizing factors, things like jobs, stable residence, those sorts of things. And so that sorts out what community risk level they would be in. A lot of the folks that are on indirect supervision are folks that have done very, very well on supervision. They've worked themselves all the way down to that level, but they still have time left on parole.
Sure. So it's not just about, taking punishment to the max, but really rehabilitating people so that they can be productive members of society.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's a balance. I mean, I think sometimes folks that are really pro-social, they think, well, if you just really supervise them very, very strictly, that's going to keep them on the straight and narrow. And what evidence-based practices and corrections will tell you is that the person gets more pro-social and is more able to, make good decisions on their own, to give them the ability to do that and to not over-supervise them. I mean, be there for the support and hold them accountable, but you don't supervise somebody who's just having a terrible time the same as somebody who's doing what they all need to do.
Sure. Lori Feiler with the Department of Corrections. She chaired the Public Safety Oversight Committee. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for the opportunity to be on your program. I appreciate it.
Thank you. And I'm Keeley Boltina here with Kara Hetland.
We're going to put a link to the full Public Safety Improvement Act report on our website. You can find that at sdpb.org.
From the scenery to Buffalo Bill to Dances with Wolves, there's a deep history of South Dakota on film.
And on today's Images of the Past, we're going to take a look at movies shot in South Dakota, right?
Or set in South Dakota.
From the very first frames of film shot in the 1890s to young filmmakers at work in the state right now. Joining us in the studio today is Brian Gevick. Thanks so much for being here.
Happy to be here.
And on the phone from Pierre in South Dakota, filmmaker Andrew Keitlinger.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so Brian, let's start with the project that you have been working on, and that is really taking us and explaining the history of film in South Dakota, and it's a program that's going to air on Sunday.
That's correct, at 3 p.m. Central, and it's really a broad overview of the history of film in South Dakota, as Keeley was mentioning, from the 1890s. I learned a lot going into this. I learned a lot on every project, but this particular one was really interesting for me because probably not many people realize that some of the first images that were shot on film in Thomas Edison's studio were of Native Americans from South Dakota. They were passing through the area with Buffalo Bill and basically said, yeah, we'll come on over and we'll do a dance for you on film. So this is 1894. And these Native men came in, and they were in their show costumes, and they did a performance for Edison's cameras. And it wasn't very long after that the first feature films involved South Dakota themes. There was a movie made in California about Custer's Last Stand. That was 1912. It was the first time that had been portrayed on film. And although it wasn't shot in South Dakota, they actually had Native actors come in from the Pine Ridge. There was a gentleman named William Eagleshirt who was born near Wounded Knee, and he went on to work quite a bit with the particular producer of this film. That's the kind of information that starts this program that airs on Sunday.
On Sunday. And so how did you get your physical hands on this video, this film?
You know, the really old films are in public domain. A lot of that is from Library of Congress. We did, however, get in touch with University of Nebraska Archives. They have a copy of a film that was shot partially in Deadwood, but mostly in the Shadron area. It's the story of Wild Bill Hickok and Calamity Jane, mm-hmm. as they wanted to tell it.
Okay.
So, yeah, not historically very accurate, but a pretty neat thing to see. The filmmakers actually came to Deadwood, and they shot themselves walking around looking at locations, and this was in 1913. The film itself came out in 1915, and it was a community film. It was just a bunch of local people who hired a guy with a camera, and they went out, and they were hoping that they were going to make some money with it. So, you know, it's a different kind of a take on what filmmaking was like in the early days. And then to go on to describe the rest of the program and make sure we get to Andrew fairly soon here, mm-hmm. There was a theme throughout early movies, and it always seemed to involve Native Americans.
Mm-hmm. And the Wild West.
Uh-huh. And films evolved, but not that much. And not even really until after the 1970s, and A Man Called Horse. And we talked briefly about that. What we did do is go to a Native American film festival. It was in Martin this year. They have had it in Rapid City in the past. And we spoke with one of the young filmmakers there who was interested in telling a different kind of story about Native life and having a look at contemporary life. And she wanted very much to make a family film. And she did. It's called Lakota Girls. And we talked to Molly Cameron at length about her project. And then, better?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
We needed a quick mic adjustment.
Okay. And then we went on to talk with Andrew Keitlinger, who I would like to get mm-hmm. to Andrew as quickly
yep.
as possible, just to explain
yep.
that we go through the history of film in South Dakota. We talk about, you know, movies like Dances with Wolves,
right.
National Treasure 2, Book of Secrets, and the other films that people are going to be familiar with, and talk about some of the business of film in the state and so on. But I think it's really important to know what people are doing now and what they hope to be doing in the future.
I'm going to ask one question, and then we are going to get to
yeah.
that. But my question is, was there a time period? I mean, we start 1890s to today, but I'm wondering if there was a chunk of time when it was kind of a dry period, when South Dakota wasn't a topic, or Native Americans and the Wild West wasn't really a topic that was being featured in films, if there was that a period of it's not about us.
Well, you know, surprisingly enough, it kind of happened between the 30s and the mid 50s.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't that there weren't movies being made, you know, old westerns and so on, is that they weren't being done here.
Right.
And when you get into the late 60s in particular, with movies like How the West Was Won, then it was coming back. The westerns never really went away, but in terms of what happened in South Dakota, not that much going on. There's one other thing I have mm-hmm. to mention. We talked to folks at Dakota State University in Madison
mm-hmm.
about a lost film that was produced there by one of the students. And it tells the story of settlement on the eastern side of the state, again involving Native Americans, but a different group in a different scenario. And that film does not exist anymore, but they have a fantastic archive of production stills. They have director's notes mm-hmm. written on the back of dry cleaner scripts. And it was a really neat community effort in 1929 to get this film released.
Okay. And Andrew Keitlinger, you are a filmmaker from South Dakota. So talk a little bit about what filmmaking is like today.
I think I agree with Brian that it's the same in many ways. The technology has evolved, and mm-hmm. maybe, you know, society has evolved, and the politics have evolved, and all these things. But at the same time, it really, I don't know, it goes back to basics every time. You know, the best way to put it is that, you know, still have a guy out there with a muffled boom mic holding it up, and you know, we're still telling stories about similar themes. I don't think the themes have changed. And I could have listened for an hour about him talking about the history of film in South Dakota. But I think, I don't know, the evolution of where it's going is just dictated by it's dictated by society, it's dictated by politics, but ultimately, why do people come and shoot here? Because of the landscape. And that's where your Westerns come in, or your grittier dramas and whatnot. So, I've made movies that I consider could classify as Westerns, but they aren't, like, definitively that genre. I've made a sci-fi Western and a modern ranch-bound Western, and the next film I'm making is a thriller kind of Western. And that's, I don't know, that's the thing about South Dakota, is that you come here and there's this virgin native land everywhere, and I almost feel like it allows every single story that's told here to feel new, as opposed to shooting in cities, for example.
Because it looks different? It's all about the scenery to make it new?
No, it doesn't look different. There's something, it's hard to explain. I'm coming at it from this artist's point of view, that South Dakota is it's very primal, and in many ways it's one of the last parts of the American frontier in a way, and I think that reads on screen. And that's why I think Hollywood's been fascinated with this area for so long. And yeah, maybe they don't shoot as many movies here as they did in the past, but I think that's going to change. And I think also the Western is something that, you know, has always, it ebbs and flows as a popular genre. But I think that'll come back soon. And I know it's just something just essential about it. And I think, yeah, a lot of Americans stay on the coast and they don't come to this part of the world, and they don't, I know, it is like an escape. Something about it is ethereal, but also primal. And it kind of reminds us of who we are as a country, if that makes sense.
It does. Talk a little bit about the film that you're currently working on.
I'm currently still writing the film right now, researching and writing a movie on human trafficking, or sex trafficking, I should say, more specifically in South Dakota. And the movie itself is, in many ways, since we were talking about Westerns originating here, is in many ways a retooling of the movie The Searchers, right, with John Wayne, which is a very classic structure and very classic story, but it's similar in that vein where it's about the search and hunt for somebody, and also in many ways, you know, hinging on the themes of when you stare long enough into the abyss, does the abyss stare back, and all those things. So that's kind of the project I'm working on now, is in essence a modern Western, kind of like Hell or High Water.
And how does filming this in South Dakota give it that new feel?
That's a great question. Well, the topic, for one, is a topic that is extremely misunderstood. I think it's one that kind of shows society. It shows that the American dream isn't perfect. And I think a lot of people assume that sex trafficking is something that happens overseas and in Thailand or in you know, Latin America or Eastern Europe, or those are the cliches anyway. But it happens here every day in the middle of the country. So I think in that sense, you're offering the audience something new, saying, you know, here is one of the most primal spots in our country. You know, the American frontier, this is, you know, America with the capital letters, and this awful thing is happening under the surface of all that. And so I think that answers your question, I hope, about how it's bringing something new to the equation. It's showing Americans we need to face this. It's a call to action, essentially.
And how are you doing your research? Walk me a little bit through the storyline.
The research, I don't want to divulge what it's about, but if you've seen The Searchers, you can get a pretty good idea. But it's, you know, the research is basically stemmed from, you know, buying every book on Amazon that I can find about the topic. And also just talking to people. You know, I had a wonderful meeting with the Attorney General Marty Jackley recently, who's a trove of information. And, you know, there's a lot of heroes and there's a lot of villains that, you know, that are part of the story. And the goal is to, you know, I've interviewed victims, I've interviewed survivors, I've interviewed advocates working on the front lines, I've interviewed task force people that are on the anti-trafficking task force, I've interviewed social workers and psychologists, and it's and also some reformed Johns, for example. So it's getting, you know, you could just write a film about it and look at it at a surface value. But in order to really really get to the essence of its complexities, you have to spend the time to do it. So it's been kind of an arduous process, and there's a lot of dark things you kind of stumble upon. For example, you know, the task force in Rapid City was very helpful in exploring deep web and dark web. And a lot of people don't know what that is, but there's, you know, this undercurrent to the internet. So that's kind of the research process, just diving in head first and being able to not be squeamish and just deal with what you see.
And Brian Gavek, I'm wondering, as you're listening to this and you've done this program on the evolution of film, how then does what Andrew is saying, how does that fit in the overall evolution of film?
Well, it's a new step forward, I think, is the main thing. I also wanted to mention that Andrew is nice enough to share quite a bit of film with us. In fact, we have a sizable portion of a short film. And Andrew, if you don't mind my saying, I think the landscape really plays a part in that particular story. It's a couple heading out in, you know, for a picnic ostensibly, and as things develop through the story, you know, it's kind of anything could happen. And when you realize the landscape that they're in, it adds to that element of the story. And some of Andrew's work is featured in the program as well. And thank you, Andrew, for that.
Yeah, no, thanks for showing it. Landscape to me is just paramount. I'm facing one of the complexities of working within, because this new trafficking film is not something that I'm doing independently. I'm working with a company in Hollywood to produce it. And my goal is to shoot it in South Dakota. And that's something that I told them early on, is that I have to shoot this here. You know, it's like, I know there's controversy about like The Revenant not shooting in South Dakota and shooting up in Canada. And that's something that I think, for me, there are sacrifices I'll have to make professionally to be able to do that. But I don't know, there's something about the landscape here that I think you're right. It creates a sense of opportunity and a sense of foreboding at the same time. Anything can happen. And that's what makes it new and exciting, in my opinion. That's what films shot outdoors in general do.
Okay, your program is called South Dakota on Film. It airs Sunday, February 26th at 3 o'clock. And Andrew, we'll continue to talk with you as well about this new project that you're on. We'd like to follow you through the process.
Absolutely. We'd love to.
Andrew Keitlinger joining us from Pierre, filmmaker. Thank you so very much. And Brian Gavek, thanks for coming in for Images of the Past.
Thank you.
Welcome back to In the Moment. I am Keely Boltina.
And I'm Kara Hedlund. We are here today. Lori Walsh is away. And now it's time to talk with our regular contributor, Hugh Weber, about his latest work on the Potluck Society.
He brings together ordinary South Dakotans who do extraordinary work. Hugh Weber, welcome back to In the Moment.
It is great to be back and with double the fun today.
Be afraid. Hugh, who are we hearing from today and how is he making a difference?
Oh, I'm so excited to share our spotlight for today, Joe Bartman. Joe is a native and resident of Montrose, South Dakota. He works with an organization called Dakota Resources in Renner, South Dakota, where he serves as vice president of community innovation. But he describes himself in an interesting way as a conversation host, a process designer, and a communication and community coach for the people of the prairie. Let's have him introduce himself.
My name is Joe Bartman. I live in little town of Montrose, South Dakota, where my wife Jamie and I are raising four daughters. I work for a nonprofit called Dakota Resources, where we are empowering people in rural places to make their communities the kind of places where they want to live. I think of myself as a conversation host, a host for conversations that matter. And most of that, for me, happens in rural places. So the reason that I say host, and you know, a lot of people would call me a facilitator. Some people call me a community coach. But I think a host shows up to create a space and allow conversations to show up, and that's really what I try to do. And so that means I'm practicing still at showing up as a not knower. And so that means I often start out by telling whatever group has asked me to come help them with something that I don't have the answers you need. I don't have the solutions, but I believe you do. And I'm going to try to help you find the questions that can break that loose, that can help you pour your wisdom into this room that is already there.
Help me understand more of this not-knower and host mentality. How is it different than the way we usually think about that?
Well, I think so often, and Joe and I talked about this at length. It'll be included in the longer form in the podcast, but I think so often when someone with a certain degree of expertise, wisdom, experience is called into a space, whether that's corporate or nonprofit or community-focused, they're expected to have answers. They're being expected to bring a PowerPoint deck and, you know, an hour of talking points, and they're this kind of sage on the stage. And I think what Joe does differently is he arrives assuming that he doesn't have the answers, or more directly, that the answers are already in the room that he's in, that sometimes we overlook these stories that are the critical element of our steps forward. And Joe has worked. I mean, he is a humble guy, and he's got kind of the pace of the rolling plains. He's got the prairie deep in him. But he, you know, helped lead downtown Sioux Falls and the Sioux Falls Green Project. He helped lead the Rural Learning Center, and now does work on a range of topics from housing to entrepreneurship. But he comes into these spaces with a really beautiful intent around questions. And he told me in the interview that a powerful question is one that has a clear purpose. I think that's something we overlook a lot of the time.
Well, we as in the average people and how we talk to each other, is that more what you're getting at?
Yeah, I think both. I think I overlooked, and I say this not as mere flattery to the two of you, but flattery nonetheless. I overlooked how hard it was to ask open-ended questions that were exploratory and discovery-focused. In the last couple months, as I've jumped into this process with the Potluck Society and in the moment, I've come to learn that it is a much different process to arrive as a not-knower than it is as a knower. And maybe we listen to a little bit more of the conversation with Joe.
Tell me a little bit about not-knowers, and I assume the inverse being knowers.
Well, I'm a knower too often, more often than I want to be, right? That's why I said I'm practicing this being a not-knower. I've been practicing it for 15 years or so, still pretty low skilled at it, but I think knowers show up with an answer. I mean, a question asks what's possible and asks what else and asks what's here. And so it's a quest, right? And an answer is just an answer. An answer is the end. It doesn't open things up. It closes things down. So in my work, often people call and ask me for some answers. And a lot of people, including me sometimes, answer that invitation by showing up as an expert and showing up with a whole bunch of knowing, a whole bunch of you should try this and have you thought of that and do you know this person and have you ever tried this thing? And that's really tempting. And so being a not knower and that practice for me is resisting that urge to say, oh, I know something. I can help you. I have an answer for you. Even when it's there, even when it's just wanting to jump out of me, because I know that in most cases, in fact, probably every case, the patience and the time and the energy that it takes to practice being a not-knower is what will actually help that person more, that client or that community, to discover in themselves what's possible. And a well-placed wicked question, wicked in the Boston sense, can totally shift people's perspective, can totally take them into a sudden jolt of self-awareness, where they not only see their own handprints on whatever the problem is that they're trying to solve, but they also see the solution within themselves.
That's a lot to take. I mean, like, that's a lot for me to think about.
Well, and I think it's not at all easy. I've had the good fortune of sitting in sessions and communities with Joe, and it is uncomfortable on both ends of the equation. If you're the host of the conversation, you have to kind of push ego aside and all of the things you do know, and be willing to sit in that discomfort. And if you're the client, if you're the community, you just want the answers.
Right.
And it's hard to sometimes sit with that question and the tension that it requires. Joe encourages us later in the interview to really practice this in our everyday life in some unusual ways, to ask ourselves at the end of the day, what have I learned today? And to think very carefully about what you're going to do with those things you've learned. And to ask in a meditative form, who am I? Which I think is something that, you know, the days click by pretty quickly. And sitting in the tension of who actually am I is a pretty deep place to be.
What's your takeaway from him in your conversation?
You know, the line that questions ask what's possible and answers are just answers, they're an end, I think is one of the most profound profound things I've heard in the last several years.
That's what I wrote down, Hugh.
Yeah, I think it's stunning. I'll say, knowing Joe and knowing him better through this conversation, he lives that place very authentically, and he brings that to the communities he serves through the Dakota Resources and his other work. Very, very genuinely, and I think it's a beautiful contribution to the region.
But it's also really difficult, if you are a knower and if you like knowing things, to be okay in this space of not knowing and to learn to feel comfortable with the discomfort. I don't know. It's going to take me a little while to work through this.
It's so tricky.
Just going to be honest.
And frankly, the world compensates knowers, right? The world celebrates expertise and celebrates those that are willing to say, I have an answer. And so to be someone willing to maybe push this a little further by going a little slower, I think is something pretty rare.
Yeah, but those questions are hard too. Who am I? Three words that are, I mean, this, yeah.
I don't know, guys, because I think every answer usually takes me to a different question.
Mm.
See, and that's why you're good at what you do.
Look at that. That's where we go with it. Oh, Hugh Weber, thank you so much. You present the Potluck Society every Tuesday here on In the Moment. Where can we find that longer conversation then?
Yeah, if you go to thepotlucksociety.com, the full site kind of went up last night, and you'll now see the couple episodes that are launched. Joe's will go up probably in the next 2 weeks. So if you go there or subscribe on iTunes, both would be very good places to look for him.
Sounds great.
Thanks, Hugh. Appreciate it.
Thank you.